At the threshold of death 1917-21, Turkish persecutions and massacre of the Assyrians during World War I, the hardships and suffering endured by my family, and our survival, Ben S. Benjamin 1980. Assyrian Empire 2000-612 BC. By the 3rd millennium BC, the Assyrians had organized their communal life into a close society. They had built cities, domesticated animals and improved agriculture. At the height of its power, the Assyrian Empire covered within its borders the countries which today are known as Syria, Iraq, known then as Mesopotamia, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, island of Cyprus, and small parts of Egypt, Turkey, and Iran. Since the fall of their empire, 612 BC, the remnants of these people have been living mainly in Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Ever since the Assyrians converted to Christianity, which was in the beginning of the 1st century AD, and mostly and particularly since the advent of Muhammad and the rise of Islam, which swept across the Middle East like a storm, the Assyrian people and other Christian minorities have been constantly persecuted by the hordes of the Islamic races. The story told in the pages following is the story of one family and a man member of this family, who as a small boy was separated from his family during the Turkish massacre of his people in World War I, and the tragic experiences endured, ere his survival during this period. This tragic story of my early childhood is told only after many years of persuasion by my business, social and church friends. Now that my three children, Barbara, William Ard Thomas, have their own children, they also have over the past years constantly asked me that I write my life experiences in order that it may become a part of their own and their children's heritage. I want to especially thank a close friend and respected attorney, here in Clearwater, Flasiaxita, without whose persistence Errol much persuasive I most probably would have continued to procrastinate and perhaps never taken the time to tell of the cruel ard gruesome experiences of my childhood during World L and the 3 years following the war, the period during the persecutions Arxi massacres, 1917-18 of the Assyrians by the Turks, ere our escape from our homeland and through many reft AD camps, 1918-20, ard our immigrant journey to the United States, 1921-22, is told here in a very condensed version. After 62 years, it is somewhat difficult to recall all the day-to-day suffering endured by the Assyrians, especially when all this took place. It occurred over a period of 3 years, 1917-21. My story of the war years is mostly concerned with the hardships of our own family Arxi, the period when I was separated from my family, or Ing the Masker, at Sangale, Shaheen Dez, Ard thereafter. In 1924, a book written published by Reverend Joel E. Werda, entitled, The Flickering Light of Asia, containing some 300 pages, vividly exacerbates the plight of the Assyrians during the war years, 1914-21. Reverend Werda was from our town of Arisai, Ari, a classmate of my father when they were in school together as young men. He was the editor and publisher of the newspaper The Assyrian Courier. In 1922, he moved his linotype and other printing equipment from New York City to Hartford, Connecticut. During the 3 years 1922-24, he was a daily at our apartment in Hartford. It was during these visits he received most of the information and material which appears in his book, The Flickering Light of Asia, from my father, and is compiled in his book. His elaboration in the book of the suffering by the Assyrians during the war years is on a much wider scale. Reverend Werda was the chairman of the Assyrian delegation attending the Paris Peace Conference in Paris, France, 1919-20. All the suffering ere pers idem sustained by the Assyrians has had a redeeming factor in their lives after the war. For a people like the Assyrians, who have lost their fatherland country to the horrendous of the Islamic people for the past 2,592 years, the redeeming factor is, they are now spread in Russia, European countries and the United States. Their situatum greatly helped and made it much easier for them to assimilate into the mainstream of every country in which they live, and with the peoples with whom they associate, without any regrets of leaving the in which they were born. Ben S. Benjamin. Introduction to History. In 1492, when Christopher Columbus set forth to a new route to India, he did not realize that he would ultimately on an island, now known as San Salvador, in the Caribbean. This unexpected error in the direction of his voyage to India resulted in the naming of the Caribbean area as the West Indies, and the discovery of the Americas. At the time of the discovery of the new continent, it would have been beyond man's comprehension that the Roo Land would eventually become a haven for all the peoples of the world. The first immigrants, namely, the Spaniards, English, Airy French, while seeking Roo opportunities and freedom as their own personal goals, also had a deep ambition to make these newly acquired areas in which they settled as colonial possessums of their native countries, with strong ties to their European fatherlands. These early settlers were soon to be followed by other immigrants from Germany, Scandinavia and Italy, and not much later by the Slavic races, Balkan states, etc. As the population grew, from the Orient came members of the Yellow race as well. During this period, despite the tremendous nine reis in man's knowledge of the world, these new settlers, and Western Europeans in general, still crew very little about the many races arxed peoples of the Middle East. Later, with the rise of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, which came to plus or minus mimp practically all of the Middle East countries, and with Great Britain's control of East India, the population of Western Europe began to learn more about the Middle East, especially when the Ottomans' adventurous campaign sought to add the Balkan states to their already massive empire. Even at that, very little was really known about the various races and ethnic groups which made up the total population of the Middle East, particularly the area known as the Fertile Crescent, the cradle of Mansa's Autumn. The Assyrians? In Advark's E of my setting forth the autobiographical story of my life, and for the benefit of my dear wife Lois, whose love, devotion and faithfulness have given me the strength and ambit why without which I could not have sustained life, and my three wonderful she-adron, Barbara, William and Thomas, and three Susan, Tamara, and Kyle, and any other descendants that may follow, I must first ard further record here in their ancestral lineage, the Assyrians. In order to accomplish the task, I must begin with the ancient history of the area at one time known as Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. In the period of 9000 to 8000 BC, during the Neolithic Revolution, the ancient people of this lard began the domestication of animals' ard crops. It was here in the Middle East, sometimes referred to as Near East, that man first began to establish permanent settlements. The very first city, Jericho, was founded during the period 8350 to 7350 BC, between 6250 to 5500 BC. The largest city was Çatalhöyük, in what is now Turkey. In 5000 BC, while Egypt was establishing its kingdom, the peoples of the Near East were busy with the development of their ovum societies and order of government. The Sumerians, whose language was different than that of the Assyrians, Babylonians, Akkadians, were one of the first people in the area. But their culture did not survive for a long period of time, and their recorded history is not too MJ, although they did make much contribution to Manchand. Following the Sumerians came the Akkadians, Agad, Assyrians, and Babylonians. During the same period there were many other societies in the Middle East, such as the Hittites, Mitannus, Amorites, etc. None of the latter built a culture that can compare with the progress made by the early Akkadians, Assyrians, and Babylonians. These people were essentially one Arxian people, with a common language, the Aramaic, the language spoken by Jesus. About 4000 BC, when the Egyptians were developing hieroglyphics as their alphabet, the Assyrians Arxi Babylonians had developed the cuneiform wedge-shaped alphabet. It is from these ancient manuscripts and carvings, on old excavated ruins of ancient cities in the Middle East, that archaeologists and anthropologists are able to decipher the writings. Arxi determined the exact TCS of ancient history. Over a period of five centuries, the Akkadians were assimilated into the kinkabims of the Assyrians and Babylonians. In 1800 BC, both the Assyrians and Babylonians began to build their empires. The Assyrian King Plis or Minasern was established by King Shamshi Adad, founder of the first Assyrian Empire. From 1800 to 1300 BC, the Assyrians kept their kingdom in it. As centuries paced on, they built the first military power known to man. The zenith of their military power was reached in 800 to 721 BC. But while the Assyrians were Kamsali and Ting their force of influence, the Medes, Persians, in the east, had become a power to be reckoned with. The Medes had always been a Tom in the side of the Assyrians fcx centuries. They finally joined forces with the Babylonians, whose language was the same as the Assyrians, on both Ate Assyria, the Medes from the east and the Babylonians from the south, and in 612 BC the Assyrian Empire was brought down to its knees by the combined forces of the Medes and the Babylonians. From that period on, Assyria was never to rise again. Only 50 years after the fall of Assyria, the increasingly powerful Medes, with more people joining them from their eastern frontier, attacked Babylon with their full military power, and this was the final death of Babylon. With the conquest of the Middle East by Alexander the Great, and later with the rise of the Roman Empire, Assyria and Babylonia, once the two greatest empires of early civilization, faded into the history of mankind. The remnants of those people, however, are still very much alive, some living near the borders of Russia, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran, the former lands of their ancestors. In 622 AD, Mulk's I Ahmed made his famous recorded journey, known to Muslims as Hijra, to the city of Medina, which became his final resting place, and with the rapid growth of Islam, the Assyrians, together with the other Christians in the Middle East, became pawns ard hostages in the hands of the Muslims. Islamic people ard their religion. The Assyrians lost their fatherland to the hordes of the Islamic peoples in 612 BC. Therefore, very little is known about these people, whose empire for seven centuries ruled not only the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East, but also eastern parts of Egypt, as well as the Islarks of Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea. André Malraux, the director of literature and art, psychologist and philosopher Georges Salles, director of the National Museums of France, together with Ardra Parrott, the well-known too, French archaeologist, in compiling their information for the publication of their book entitled The Arts of Assyria State, no people have more claim to the Middle East than the Assyrians. Yet the only time the name Assyria was, and is, ever mentioned among the peoples of Europe or the West, is during their church services. Their ministers and preachers, when quoting from the books of the Old Testament, will often mention the names Assyria or Babylonia, since they are referred to in the Bible many times. Even so, not too my people see or notice my significance in the names, but it was the Middle East that gave rise to man's civilization. The area where the Assyrians come from is inside Iran, but being within 10 to 20 miles from the Turkish border, it is strongly demented by Turkish culture and influence, and also by the Russian Georgian, 60 to 70 miles to the north. Prior to World War I, the Iranum central government had little or no power nor influence in the area. Most of the town's Axi villages paid no taxes to the Iranian government. At the point where Turkey, Iran, Arxi, Iraq have a common border, in each of the three countries there is a large population of Kurds. The Kurdish people are a race by themselves, neither Iranian, Turkish, nor Iraqi. There are between 3b to 5 million of these people. They are a hardy race, living mostly in the mountain regions of the three countries. Prior to 1918, there were some notorious bandits among them. One of the most notorious bandits was Simcoe. Simcoe's banditry was very similar to TFNT of the famous Mexican, Pancho Villa, whose real name was Doratio Arango, changed to Francisco Villa. After Villa had made several raids on the towns and villages inside of the state of Texas, President Woodrow Wilson ordered the U.S. Army, under General Pershing, to Yorsu capture him. General Pershing did not capture him, but did stop his raids. In 1923, Villa was finally assassinated. Following the fall of their empire, for the next six centuries life was intolerable for the Assyrians and other Christian minorities, whose very life existence had fallen into the harris of the hordes of Islam. Islam's teachings, which condone murder and killing in the name of Allah, by calling holy wars known as jihads, were always a fear in the Mirdzarksi hearts of all Christians wherever they lived. A non-believer in Islam is considered an infidel, gavur. As such, he is an enemy of Islam. The Kurdish people are also of Islamic faith. I will never forget my courageous mother. God bless her. And an incident when a notorious Armenian bandit, whose was Artush, together with his outlaws knocked on the front gate of our house. The houses were usually built so that two or three close relatives lived in a comradum complex, with a solid cement wall forming a six-foot-high fence around the complex, and a double gate. My mother saw the bandits, she immediately turned back in the house and went for my dad's rifle, a German Mauser. Slipping the magazine into it, she went up tall roof, late MD pointed her rifle at Artush, telling him that before could shoot at her, she would at least kill two of them. Artush was simply stunned by my mother's display of courage. He ordered his men to hold back and not shoot, telling my dear mom, "Lady, I admire your courage and I give you my word of honor, nothing will happen to your FK me or family. Will you at least let come in for a cup of tea, chai?" My mother, complying with his request, came HWN from the roof, opened the gate to the yard, and three of the bandits came in the house and were served tea. As my dad told me, when Artush and his men were leaving our IMAGs, they removed THRIX2Ts, my for ha hospitality, and left. The raids by bandits small outlying towns and villages were a common occurrence. Despite their persecutions, the Assyrians and other minorities had always enjoyed a much higher social and economical standard, and were better educated than the Muslims. This, of course, was a thorn in the Muslim side. When the Tsar of Russia was in power, because the Assyrian Orthodox was closely tied to the Russian Orthodox Church, the Tsar was always ready to protect the Assyrians from tip ravages of Islam. Prior to MD during the war, the Russian army was stationed in Azerbaijan for the safety of the Assyrians. Near the end of World War I, Nikolai Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, as the leader of the Socialist and Communist Party, led the uprising and revolution in Russia. Myth: the execution of Tsar Nicholas I and the massacre of his entire family by the leaders of the revolution in 191-7, the Russian armed forces became and the entire stationed in Azerbaijan crumbled, leaving every man for himself, and all left for their homes and families across the border into their own country. This was a tragic move, for it left the Assyrians wide open for a Turkish attack. It was not until 1890 and 1900 that the very first Assyrians migrated to the United States. But in the period just prior to World War I, and immediately following the war, even greater numbers migrated, as the result of the Turkish massacres of Christians. Assyrian Christianity dates back to the period when Christ and his disciples were preaching the word of God. It was during Christ's life on this earth that the then leader of the Assyrian people requested that Christ come to him personally and explain his new philosophy. At that time, the Assyrians were worshippers of many mythical gods, namely, Ashur, the god of war 1500 Empire, Shamash, sun god as deity of crops and righteousness, Ishtar, goddess of love and fertility, etc. The name Assyria was taken from god of war and empire, Ashur. They were known as the Ashurians, and later, Assyrians. Christ sent his disciple, Simon Peter, to see the Assyrian leader, and it was Simon Peter who converted the Assyrians to Christianity. In the period between 1825-28, the Presbyterian Church in the United States sent its first missionaries to the northern province of Azerbaijan, in Iran, near the Turkish border. The Presbyterian mission was aware that there were some Christians in the area, and thought it best to work through these Christians in their effort to convert some of the Mohammedans, whose religion was Islam, to Christianity. The establishment of this mission was in the city of Hermia, which is located on the west coast of Lake Hermia, one of the three saltiest lakes in the world. Tihi city of Hermia is within a short distance of the Turkish border, at about 65 miles south of Russian Georgia. A large number of Assyrian Christians inhabited the mountains in the eastern area of Turkey, adjoining the Iran border. So when the missionaries' efforts to convert the people of Islamic religion met with no success, they redirected their efforts to the Assyrians in the area. When the missionaries began AMG the Assyrians, all of the Assyrians belonged to the Nestorian Orthodox Church, or the Eastern Apostolic Church, which is a root of the Greek and Russian Orthodox Church. During the period 1825-30, the Presbyterian Church was established in the city of Hermia. Immediately, many of the Assyrians gave up the Nestorian Church and joined the newly established Presbyter Im Church. Not too long after, the Warda family, which later was to be known as Benjamin, established the first Presbyterian denomination and church. In the town of Ardashai, situated on the west beach of Lake Hermia, 8 to 10 miles southeast of the city of Hermia, it was very common practice among the peoples of the Middle East to use the father's name as the surname. My grandfather's name being Benjamin, the name Warda was dropped from usage. My father and the rest of the Warda clan have been using my paternal grandfather's first name Benjamin as the family surname since about 1863. World War I. Russian army leaves. Turkish massacre. During the period between 1914-18, Turkey, which was an ally of Germany, had its troops stationed both in the Balkan states in the west and at the Rus-Iranian border in the north and east. The Russian army was holding its positives against Turkey in the Caucasian mountains on the north and at the Turkish-Iranian border on the east. But when the Russian army withdrew from the war zone in this area due to Lenin's revolution, its army stationed in the Caucasus was RX, longer there to protect the Assyrian and Armenian minorities. The Turks, who had a hatred of all Christianity, had been kept under pressure by the Russian army. In the absence of Russian power in the area, however, the Turkish army, under the leadership of the famous general Mustafa Kemal Pasha, who later was named Kemal Atatürk, father of Turkey, and his close associate Enver Pasha, had some time to reconsolidate their positions at the two eastern borders. In the meantime, the Kurdish bandit Simko, also considered by his people to be their leader, was secretly working with both the Turkish and Iranian governments for the annihilation of the Assyrians. Simko's hope was that by annihilating the Assyrians, he would get an autonomous rule for his people who lived in both Turkey and Iran. Simko requested a summit meeting with his Beatitude Mar Shaman, Saint Simon, who was at the time both top religious leader of the Orthodox Church and political leader of the Assyrians. Mar Shim accepted Simko's invitation, took an entourage of approximately 100 well-armed men with him, because Simko was known to be untrustworthy. As the carriage carrying Mar Shimon reached Simko headquarters, he was graciously greeted by Simko's guards. As Mar Shimon approached the enter, you're of Simko's inner quarters, the Kurdish leader received him like a servant. I.L. Bowing before his master, the two leaders' discussions were most amicable. One of Mar Shimon's men had observed the shadows of some men the very Ikridge roof of the headquarters, not realizing there were actually several hundred of Simko's armed men hiding on the rooftop and all around the buildings. When Simko bade Mar Shimon revoir, no sooner had Mar Shimon and his entourage stepped outside of the yard, then a barrage of gunfire opened simultaneously from all directions, killing the religious leader and 90 of his men. Of the 10 men who escaped, 6 were wounded. This act by a vicious Muslim leader was to seal the fate of the Assyrians. The Turks first attacked the Assyrians living in the mountain area of eastern Turkey. This was also the area where Lois' parents originally came from. As mountaineers began to flee across the border into Iran, the Assyrian Irregular Army, under the Assyrian general Aga Petros, were successful in slowing down the advance of the well-trained MD-equipped Turkish army. Unfortunately, the Assyrian army military equipment was made up of arms from three different sources: rifles manufactured in France, Germany, and Russia, which meant that there were three bullet types, and not EMU ammunition reserve for my one of them. Word came from the war zone admonishing the civilian population to leave their towns and villages and head toward Hamadan and Kermanshah, which was a aiming distance. The mass evacuation began immediately. My uncle Paul was one of the soldiers who brought the warning. Later was caught and executed by the Turks. My youngest uncle, Peter, was taken prisoner by the Turks. My grandmother, Hannah, discovered the location where Peter was held. She proceeded to go and see him. As she approached the small Turkish contingent, she was stopped by the guards. When she forced herself against them, she was knocked down to the Grarksi-Arksi, bayoneted to death by one of the guards. Not much later, my mother and aunt found that their brother, Uncle Peter, had choked to death by his captors. 1-2. The Assyrians' frontline FCXs, despite the Turkish army's alarming superiority in manpower, ammunition, and logistics, succeeded in keeping the Turks at the Thiye border, allowing the Assyrian civilian population time to flee from the city of Hermia and the surrounding towns and villages. At the Esyun time, my parents began their preparation to escape from what ultimately resulted in the great Turkish massacre of the Assyrians. My father, mother, older sister, younger brother, younger sister and I took whatever possessions our parents were able to load on a wagon, plus two horses, two mules and one buffalo, leaving all other worldly possessions and home behind. I was 10 years old. As we proceeded south and could no longer see the site of our village of Aran Shai, we began to see thousands of other Assyrians who had left their homes and towns. In addition to my father, mother, older sister Martha, younger brother William and younger sister Julia, my older married sister Soraya, her husband and infant son Jonathan, were also alongside with us. Apparently there must have been someone many miles ahead directing or mapping the way, because there were no visible roads to follow. Not too, my after our departure, my married sister Soraya's infant son died. Due to the advancing Turks, some miles to the rear of the civilians, there was RX, time for burial. So my sister Axel her husbergs tied the corpse of their infant son on horseback, with the hope that there would be a rest period ironing our escape, in order for them to bury him underground. The expected peaceful period never made her realized. I shall never forget how the entire family, including some friends, after hearing the sounds of Turkish cannon fire in the distance, pleaded with Soraya and her husband and finally persuaded them to leave the young boy's corpse on the side of the road. He was finally wrapped in a blanket MD placed under a rock. Some soldiers came from the rear where the Turks had been advancing and 13. Recruited more able-bodied men to go back and try to hold back the advancing Turks. A few days later, word came that the Turks were held in check and many prisoners had been by the Assyrians. After 8 or 10 days of constant journey by wagons, horses and foot, the people were told that they could RMS rest for the night. In the meanwhile, something had happened to the wheel of our wagon and my father had abandoned it behind us. The thousands of men, women, RE children rested all in the open spaces near the Iranian town of Shaheen Dez, Saint-Cole. As the morning began to burst from the horizon, the rested population were warned to get up and leave, as the Turks were advancing and within hours the camp would be attacked. As small as I was, I will never forget the panic and the pandemonium amongst the people. In a matter of minutes after the warning, the cannon shells began exploding in the midst of the crowds. My dad had strapped me on the back of the water buffalo, as I had come down with malaria. In the excitement, before my dad realized, the animal had taken me away and headed for a small river just outside of where camping was for the NW1T. In its approach to the Zarin River, the thirsty animal jumped from the riverbank into the river with me strapped to his back. As the animal was drinking water Arksi swimming, he crows to the opposite side of the river. He got up to land, which was about the same level as the level of river height. The animal kept shaking his body, cue errantly in order to shake off the excess water or water and ops, and in so the straps which held me to his back loosened and I fell off into the ground. The animal started to run away along the dry edge of the river, howling and screaming. As the people left the camp, a half mile away from the spot where I had fallen, my aunt had seen a water buffalo with loose straps on its back and showed it to my father. The area where the animal was spotted was shallow. My father had gone on horseback across the river, but nowhere could he find my trace of me. He took the animal again and crossed the river, joining the migration of the people. He had told my mother that he was sure that their son, Ben, was drowned in the river, and he could not discover the body. I must have fallen asleep immediately after falling down, because I woke up thinking it was early morning, but the sun, instead of rising, was setting. Then I realized that I must have slept all. As I looked around me, I saw something a short distance from me that looked like a bridge. I got up and walked toward it, and as I approached it, I saw it was a broken wooden bridge with small rocks, the tops of which were exposed above the shallow water under the eye. Sat under the forecover Arksi as the evening was approaching, I heard someone calling, "Son, are you Assyrian?" In my crying voice, I'm assured, "Yes, I am Assyrian." This was an old woman with two smaller children than I, and an older girl. After bitter crying, I asked her about my father Ard mother. She said she didn't know who they were. She put her arms around me and started crying, telling me that her son and his wife had been killed. Ari, the three kids with her were her grandchild Adrian, all slept under that bridge that night. The next morning we woke and washed our hands, Ari faces. Ari, the old Warnham had a white sheet with which she let me wipe my wet hands and face. Suddenly across the river we saw some soldiers. The soldiers waved, Ard signaled us to come to them. We all slowly cruised over the shallow water along the underneath of the broken bridge, carefully holding onto the posts of the brick percent E. As we approached these men with our clothes wet to our knees, we saw that they were Turkish soldiers. They asked the old woman who we were and we were doing there. In Turkish, the woman told them that we were Assyrians and were left behind. At that point, me of the soldiers picked Q, the Oman's older granddaughter Arxi, put her in the arms of a soldier who was still mounted on his horse. At the time, I didn't know the young girl was struggling so hard to get herself out of the arms of the mounted soldier. Suddenly, the soldier threw her down to the ground, Errol with a bayonet attached to the muzzle of his rifle. He said, "Why, you gave her Kopak Ogli, you infidel SOB," and stabbed her to death. 15? The old woman was screaming, Ard pulling her hair. Her grandchildren were crying. I stood there and froze, shaking like I was freezing to death. Suddenly something happened to me. I felt as if someone came from behind Arxi and pulled a piece of my skin, the width of a 3/4-inch surgical tape, right from the top of my head and the BCK all the way down my back and both legs. One of the other soldiers pointed his rifle at me, said, "Let us kill all these Chiar Ischin Gavors, infidels." My God was there with me, because another soldier leaned over and pulled the soldier's muzzle away, saying, "Don't waste my bullets, these. Let us lure them to die from starvation." As the soldiers left, they were only a short distance away from us when suddenly we heard cannon shells bombarding the high hillside. It must have been hours before we dared to leave the spot where the Turkish soldiers left us. As we reached the top of the hill, we realized the Turks had camped there the day before. We saw many dead soldiers and much equipment left. At the time we didn't know the Assyrian general Aga Petros and his men, when capturing some of the Turkish troops, had also taken some military equipment, which included Kanem's mounted horse, driven caissons. Due to distances and also weakness in their army, the Turks had pulled BCCK, their Divisimiz general Aga Petros, had cut off this last contingent of Turks in the area. The cannon bombardment we had heard was from the Assyrians, who were using the captured Turkish equipment in their Furxal Annihilatum of the last remark. One NTS of the Turkish army, an army that masquered thousands of helpless Assyrian men, women and children, oh, because their fanatic religious leaders and their Islamic doctrine justifies the call for a holy war, Ari, any non-believers in Islam are enemies of Islam. We were able to follow the road direct to El only by seeing the number of dead on the road and the personal belongings left behind, together with abandoned wagons, horses and many other animals. One sight I saw, unlike many others, was a dead mother with a swollen stomach DJ to exposure, with her small infant child sucking her breast for milk. The old woman with the grandchildren was God sent to me, because for days before reaching Bijar, she would go to search food in the abandoned wagmams, and many times she would bring and feed us lavasha, thin sheets of bread. Dry as it was, with the stale bread umter, we survived. We must have been just outside of the city of Bijar, when we saw several men coming toward us. We got real close to them. I started to cry. One of them, dressed in Russian Cossack coat and fur hat, said in Turkish, "Don't cry, Oglan son, we're not going to yurt you. These are Injiliz Askerler, English soldiers." Despite his consoling words, this did not alleviate my grief until the old Warnham came. Arxt hugged me and told me it was alright. We were safe. The man who spoke Turkish was neither Turkish nor English, but the rest of TLM turned out to be English commanding officers, Ard, several others, about 10 to 15 of them total. They had 5 or 6 unmanned but saddled horses. I must have been too weak. Becca G. Orr of them picked me and put me on the front of his own saddle, and the woman and her grandchildren were put in some sort of small army wagon. We were taken some distance until we reached their headquarters, where there were several other soldiers and a doctor. Before MD, I was being fed and given some medication with water. The water was bitter as hell and I could hardly drink it, but the doc TCX insisted. Later I found out it was powdered quinine in water, given to combat my malaria. After a day or so, I no longer saw the old kind woman or her grandchildren. I found out this spot where the British were camping was about 60 kilometers southwest of the city of Hamadan. This small unit of British commanding officers was sent ahead, and it was to have been followed by the British armed F-Sizes. They were to support General Aga Petros' forces to prevent the Turkish advance which resulted in the Great Massacre. But this small British commanding unit was headed BCK to Baghdad. Upma reaching the tail end of the refugee line, the refugees kept asking their interpreter, who was not English, "Where are the English Sol and T soldiers? Percent air are the English Sadati soldiers?" Their interpreter, in an apologetic way, shrugged his shoulders as if to say, "We don't know." A short while later, the Turkish interpreter asked me if I understood Turkish. I answered, "Very little." "Thal," he said, "you see there, those are all your people and you are to go where they are. because we are retombing to Baghdad. Left alone, I walked toward the people who were camped at what tombed out to be on the outskirts of the Iranian city of Kagh, Isharin, which is located very near to the border of Iraq. It appeared as though there were thousands of them in the open space, but I saw not me face that was familiar to me. I stayed there THNT after Nam M night. The conversation I heard was mostly about lost people and separated families. In the mid-morning I heard people say they had to leave. As some began to leave, I followed them. I became quite ill, and a kindly man saw me unable to walk. He picked me up, Arksi put me in his wagman with three or four other children who were much younger. I don't recall the time it took to reach a town by the Ayarin of Khanakin. It couldn't have been too far because we got there in a short time. Khanakin was just inside of the Iraqi border. We stopped not too far from the town, and the man told me THNT he heard there were some people from my town of Ardashai. He reached over and took me off his wagmam and told me to go among the crowd. Widenhod reached there the high before? I must have had a high temperature and was unable to walk with much confidence. All of a sudden I saw a boy. He was my cousin Jack. I hollered, T-Y-K-O, Y-K-O, Jock, 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 Jock. He ran away as if he feared me. Yako was me, year younger than I, but weak as I was, suffering from malaria, I was in condition to run after him. I saw him in the distance talking to a Warnamard, he was pointing towards me. As I got nearer to the crowd, suddenly this woman started running toward me, crying ard, screaming. It was my mother? She grabbed percent Edmi Ard, took me in her arms, kissed me and cried bitterly, and kept calling my father, Schlemmen, Schlemmen, Schlem, Schlem? My father was busy with another man, with whom he was to share a young IM for meat. As my father tombed toward my mother in answer to her call, he saw me, and with the butcher knife still in his hand, he raised both hands together with his head to the sky and screamed, Zero my God, oh God, oh my God, oh God. With the butcher knife in his hand, he rushed and grabbed me away from my mother, hugged and kissed me, asking me, Ben, Mahir, have you been all this time? Before I had a chance to answer him, he said that a woman from our town had told them not to worry. Your son is dead. Be thankful THNT he doesn't ho, e to suffer this misery. She had told them that when she and her husband were on the road seeing all the dead people, she had noticed a young Diyad boy who was run over by a horse-drawn army caisson. She knew it was their son Ben, because she turned his face to see if it was him. My father, being a devout Christian, which he was, said a prayer. I finally got some composure. I asked where were Martha, William, and Julia. My mother said, look, Martha was standing. W.Y. Ilium and Julia were sleeping. I asked, percent high are they sleeping? My mother said, they are not well. Soon thereafter, my brother William, who was 2 years my junior, woke up, and my dad said, William, William, look who is here. William just looked, Ard said, in a very weak voice, bien. The next morning, William never woke up. He had died? Both he and Julia were suffering from malaria. My father, Ard, another man, took William's corpse a distance away, dug under a rock, covered him with a cloth, and buried him. 2 days later my sister Julia, who uns 5 years old, died in the same manner as William, and she was buried in a like manner. My father had been given some quinine for Yvium and Julia by the medical team working with the sick. I finally got too sick with fever and chills, definite signs of malaria. He started me on quinine 3 times a day and before going to bed. While we stayed at this camp, which was out in the open with only some trees, just outside of Khanakin, there were thousands of others who were also scattered all over the vast open land waiting the outcome of their undetermined fate. Official word came that the British High Commerksy had ordered a camp set up just outside of the city of Bakuba, not too far from Baghdad, Iraq. The final move to Camp Bakuba was no surprise to my one, as the people were looking forward to it. We got to the camp. There they were, large army tents accommodating 60 persims to each tent. I don't recall the number of tents to a section. There were a large rumber in a section. There were 30 sections. Our section was number 22. Every known LRS ARI 6 known to Hums was there. Malaria, typhoid, malnutrition, just to a few. A large tent was set up for a clinic. Prior to the arrival of the refugees, an extensive sanitation complex had been set. After staying at Camp Bakuba for quite a long period of time, some of the re-at-ease decided to go BCL less than to their homes ARI villages in Azerbaijan. The British government was not in favor of such a move by the refugees, so it was necessary for those who wished to return to there to sign a release showing that the signatories, leaving Camp Bakuba, were at the same time releasing the British government and its high command of all responsibility for their safety and welfare. My father signed the release on behalf of the family Ard himself. Other memorabilia, I have an exact copy of the original release my father signed with the British. Immediately we left for Baghdad. From there we were placed army buses and headed for Mosui. My father and some other men set up a temporary camp in Miandoun, Rizult on the X of the Tigris River. During our stay there, my father took me with him to Mosui, which was not too far from Minden. It was during this trip, after he got through with whatever business he had to TRMSCCT, TLNT, he said, "Son, would you like to go and see the ruins of Nineveh just across from Mosul?" I knew nothing of Nineveh, and I said, "Yes, Baba, father." It was no more than 2 or 3 kilometers away. I was in awe of the acres and acres of massive ruins, and the small portions of ancient walls still remaining. I looked at my father and noticed tears coming down, and I asked if he was crying and why. 1 mth a choking tone in his voice, he picked me up. Ard said, "Son, thousands of years ago, this was the capital city of our people." He put me down and we retombed to Minden. Within a short period of time, the people at the camp decided to send a small armed group of able-bodied men to go over the mountain terrain and see if there was a passage through the mountains to the border of Iran. Mosul is approximately 600 kilometers north of Baghdad, and the distance to Turkey, Iraq, Iran was very close, just over the mountains. The distance to Lake Urmia was not too far from there. The small armed group of men left Ard, Arnu, and to their chagrin, they were met by a fierce tribe of Kurds. The Kurds knew the terrain and they outnumbered the small Assyrian group. After some exchange of rifle fire, only a few of the Grotpi survived. One of my first cousins came back alive, and he had the corpse of another relative strapped the BCK of his saxel. It was then my father decided we should go BCK to Baghdad. I was too small to know all the secrets of my family, but I recall, when we left Ar and Shai, my mother used to put a heavy vest-like jacket on me. But when I got sick, just before I was separated from them at Saini Kae, they took the vest off. We were in Bakuba camp. I found out that my father, mother and sister Martha also had similar vests, and that long before we left home in Ar and Shai, my mother sewn Iranian gold money in the lining of all our vests and the saddles of the mules. I remember my father making several trips to Baghdad while we were at the Bakuba camp. He had been taking small amounts of gold and depositing it with a Chaldean man who was introduced to my dad by a friend. The Chaldeans are also Christians and speak a dialect which is similar to Aramaic, and they have been in Baghdad ever since they lost their country of Chaldea to the Hore and S of Islam. Upon our return to Baghdad, my father received a letter from my oldest brother Para, who had been sent to the United States to further his education. In his letter, Para told my father that to try to go back to our homeland just for the of being near the Virvards, Farmlarks, the other property which our family owned, was eerie to Devasabi, i.e., because the Islamic countries would never be safe Christimity. After a great deal of deliberation, and having given serious consideration to Para's letter, my father went to the American Chemilate in Baghdad Arxt, applied for M immigration visa to the United States. Leave our homeland. The long journey to America. The next step was to wait for our quota, which had to be in accordance with the number of immigrants who were allowed to enter the United States. The waiting list was long, and before anyone was allowed to enter the United States, he or she was given a rigid physical examination. Anyone who failed the examination was immediately put the ship and retombed to the last port from which he or she boarded ship. I don't recall the of time it took to gain permission for our passage from Baghdad. IKRMST that it came sometime either the latter part of 1920 or the early part of 1921. It would have been much easier to go west across Iraq and Syria to a shipping port on the Mediterranean Sea for passage to the United States, but unfortunately this was not possible. It was only about 2 years after the signing of the armistice ending World War I. Prior to the war, Lawrence of Arabia had agitated the Arabs in a rising against the Ottoman Turkish Empire. In 1920, under a treaty by the League J of Nations, Great Britain was given a mandate to rule Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq. The same body of nations gave France the man and tay to rule Syria, Ari, Lebanon. Our visa to emigrate to the United States was FERC 211Y approved by the Bureau L of Immigration, but since there was RX available land route from Baghdad across Iraq and Syria to the Mediterranean seaports, we had no other alternative but to go by the British-controlled route, which was on shipping lanes through the Tigris River, Indian Ocean, Red Sea, and Suez Canal. This meant a distance of over 5,000 miles, instead of about 600 miles throughout 8H the land route. We left Baghdad on the riverboat Ramad Maji and to the port of Basra, at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. It took 4 days and nights. After waiting a few highs at the port, we got passage on the British cargo liner Castalia, leaving Basra on a route going south the Persian Gulf area southeast the Indian Ocean. After 14 on the rough Indian Ocean, we landed at the port of one of India's largest cities, Bombay. Remained of our belongings the family had salvaged, was put a carriage-type wagmam and driven to a hotel-type building in the Baikala section of Bombay. There we rented me room, which was quite an improvement over the camps we had experienced. We stayed there for several months. The malaria I was suffering from got worse in Bombay, again with high fever ARXI chills every other afternoon. I was given the same dreadful and bitter powdered quinine mixed in water, 3 times a, high ARI before going to bed. When we were in Baghdad, my brother Para had sent my dad the sum of $1, 200.00. This money reached my father just a katolshes before we were to board the riverboat Majida. So dad was unable to fixy time to purchase some persim carpets, which had been requested by my brother in his letter. However, during the months we remained in Bombay, dad was able to purchase several large ard small carpets, which were bundled and shipped to my brother, who at the time was living in Hartford, Connecticut. Our next instimption was the port of Marseille-Isles, France. Our passage to Marseille finally came, and we boarded a British ocean liner, the of which escapes me now, at D headed southwest on the Indian Ocean, around the southern peninsula of Saudi Arabia and South Yemen, through the Strait of Adam into the Red Sea, and Thralu won the Suez Canal going north to the strategic port Said, Egypt. We were in a cargo ship, so it made many stops. The ship docked for loading unloading goods. The next day our ship headed for the port of Tunis, and after several days it docked at the port of Tunis, Tunisia, the Mediterranean Sea. As in Port Said, the next day we again headed for the port of Marseille, France. After 18 days on the Indian Ocean, Red Sea and Mediterranean Sea, we landed in Marseille, France. We were taken to an old hotel near other immigrants who were also anxiously waiting to sail to the United States. It just so happens that I have a business card at the hotel. Royalties and Kursal Hotels, 12/14, Rue Thubano, 12/14, Marseille Lies. DMT be misled by the fancy name. Although it was like a palace compared to the room we had in Bombay, India, this business card, also AMG My Memorabilia, is almost 60 years old. It was the latter part of December 1921 that we boarded the French liner SS Roma and sailed cross to Barcelona, Spain to load cargo. We stayed overnight in Barcelona, and the next day headed for the Strait of Gibraltar, into the Atlantic Ocean, aeroled a trip which was to take 13 days from Marseille to the coast of the United States. Due to the large influx of immigrants from all the European countries coming to the United States right after the /HKR, the United States government, in addition to Ellis in New York Harbor, had opened a port at Providence, Rhode Island. The SS Roma was directed to this second port. We arrived at Providence, Rhode Island, on January 9, 1922. After we underwent 9 days of rigid physical examinations and tests, my brother Para Art, his wife Sophie, came and drove us in their touring car to 52 Spring Street, Hartford, Connecticut. My brother's apartment was quite large, airy. The accommodations were much more than we had ever anticipated. His wife Sophie was a woman of great compassion and understanding, with deep love in her heart for all of us. There were two other Asiram Fami Lies living in Hartford, but neither one of them had any children. At the age of 13, alone in a new environment, I was haunted by the tragic experience of Masker's death. I was finally enrolled in school. It was quite unlike today, where new immigrants are demanding that their own ethnic language and culture be maintained, and our government is acquiescing by providing them with S+ or Minusul facilities and teaching staffs to teach their own languages, and by hiring bilingual policemen, one other government employees with whom they are more able to identify. This certainly was not the case with the earlier immigrants, rightly so, for they were glad to arrive in the United States and learn to speak English, even in the most difficult manner, get a job, and not expect to be a burden the government airy American taxpayers. Every Or has a right and should be proud of their ancestral background. I am proud to be of an ancestral background whose early contributum to man's civilizatum is well recorded in the history of the world. My parents chose the United States as their adopted country. They lived, became citizens, and died here. From early childhood I have lived here, arxi will die here. Therefore, I have no loyalty to the country in which I was born. Whenever I have to and must make a choice between the country of my birth and the country of my adoption, the former is a dream, a nightmare art. The latter is a happy reality. Hartford, Connecticut, 1922-27, the move to Chicago. A new life begins. During the 5.5 years we lived in Hartford, while I was attending school, I also worked after school and on Saturday and Y. We first arrived in the United States, my brother had a small contracting business. Later, having sold all of the persim carpets my father had bought shipped to him from Bombay, India with the $1,200 Para had sent to him, Para decided to give 14, the contracting business art go into the Oriental rug business. In 1927, a man whom my parents and brother knew in Hermia came to Hartford to visit. My brother was persuaded to FRN a new company and establish it in Chicago. The man, Reverend Isaac Yonan, my brother Para, and Ephraim Shedd formed a company. Mr. Shedd was the son of John Shedd, who was the dean of the American Mission, as well as an American vice consul in Hermia. My father had known the Shi family for many years. Ephraim Shedd was bomb in Hermia and spoke fluent Assyrian. His first cousin, Rufus Dawes, a Chicago banker whose brother, Charles G. Dawes, was vice president of the United States under President Calvin Coolidge, invested $5,000 in behalf of Ephraim Shedd in the of the Oriental rug business. I was 19 and had already made so many friends my age I hated to leave Hartford. But at that age, a boy had to move and follow his family wherever they were to go. In July 1927, the move from Hartford, Connecticut to Chicago was accomplished. In Chicago, I used my talent, which I acquired by serving apprenticeship in Hartford with William Dupree Company, who were painting contractors and designers. After working a year with two different contractors in Chicago, I finally got a job with a large painting company, which was a subsidiary of a large CMSTRW Tim company. At this time, not only was I in a unique positive in a business in which I had served as an apprentice, but the opportunity was wide open for me to learn more about building Camastrella Tim and also the workings of many subcontractors, of which the general construction business is made up. It was in late 1927 one met Lois Y. Onan for the first time. During the next year and a half, I saw her several times in church and other social groups. In 1929 came the big stock market crash. The country's economy seemed to waver and the future appeared bleak. The company with which I had some feeling of security, together with its parent company, proceeded to file bankruptcy and I was out of a job. I used to go back to the shop and talk with other fellow workers, but there was nothing available. On one of the occasions when I was visiting at the shop, the vice president of the company called me over the side and said, "Look, Ben, we are going to close up. My, don't you start in your own business?" He suggested a realty company, a client of theirs, whose owner always wanted that young Italian. Most everybody thought I was Italian, sent to his jobs. In the early spring of 1930, I developed enough courage to go and see the man. I got a few small jobs, but had no capital to hire workers. For the first 2 months, I worked 10 hours a day all by myself. Soon thereafter, I got a few more customers and I employed one man. In the next 14 or 16 months, I was employing six men. At this same period in time, Lois and I were dating at least once a month. In February-March 1932, one received a notice from the bankruptcy court, notifying me that the realty company with whom I first started Ching business had, in fed, filed a petitum for bankruptcy. This was a serious blow to me, because they owed me over $1,500, which was the largest portion of capital I had. In January 1932, Lois and I made plans to get married that fall. Much to her surprise, I presented her with a half-carat diamond engagement ring. In the meantime, in 1931, my brother had moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. This shifted the responsibility of my parent support to me. On our date me day, Lois asked if I was in a positive to support her and my parents at the same time. I told her, as a matter of fact, what money I had, and that most of it would be wiped out due to the bankruptcy of a customer. She looked despondent and asked me what we were going to do without money. My answer was, and she always remembers it, that if there is a loaf of bread somewhere, I will get a piece of it. The summer of 1932, I worked hard and put in long hours, and saved an additional $700. On November 26, 1932, our expected dream became a reality. For on that day we were joined in holy matrimony at the 4th Presbyterian Church, by Lois's uncle Reverend Hato Ablahat and George L. Robinson, who was a professor of theology at the McCormick Theological Seminary, a close of Lois's father. Due to our economic situation, we had my parents living with us. This arrangement proved to be of Rx, happiness to either of us. We moved to the upper floor of the same building and rented ourselves another apartment, leaving our second floor apartment to my parents, with me signing their lease and being responsible for their well-being. I was operating my business.s out of the apartment, with a shop building for our operation one block away from our apartment. Lois was helping me by Ching all the typing and telephone answering, while I was estimating, supervising and oftentimes helping the men on the jobs. For the next 6 years, this was the pattern of our life. In 1938, our Barbara was born. With her birth, she brought us good fortune. By 1940, I was swamped with work from all directions, and I had to buy a new TRWK Arxie hire a full-time truck driver. I placed one of my men in a supervisory positive. That same year we bought our first home. It was a 7-room bungalow, built in 1923. My knowledge of the construction trades came in harrow. We remodeled the entire house, with me doing the major part of the work in the late afternoons, evenings, Saturdays and Sundays. We moved in the house after all the remodeling and painting was completed. In 1942, our Bill was born. In 1943, when Lois was pre-GTX1NT with our son Tom, we hired a Mrs. Stanley, who came to live with us on a full-time basis to take charge of our two children. In March 1944, Tom was born. In 1940, immediately after we the house, we built a large garage-type building for our use as a shop, with our office in the basement of our home. In the latter part of August 1944, my mother became ill and I took her to the Presbyterian Hospital. She was there for a short period. Wednesday, I received a personal call from Dr. Robert Johannesson, telling me that mother was not well, and requesting that I go down to the hospital. I wasn't aware that WHM he called me. Mother was already dead. I immediately rushed to the hospital and the nurse duty escorted me to a private room in which my mother was laid a cot in the center of the room. As the nurse and I approached the cot, the nurse said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Benjamin, your mother died." At this point, I had no control of my emotions. I just simply threw myself across her corpse and cried bitterly, remembering all the tragical airy persecute WRS we suffered together, and what a great giant she was in guiding us through it all. She was a great mother and a lady with exceptional courage. I shall never forget her ard, my dad. A few days after her funeral, Lois and I went to close their apartment and bring my father, who at the time hadn't been able to see too well, to live with us. My mother, on many occasions, had told me that my father would not live more than 6 months after her death. She was so right, because his sight got worse as time went by. One evening my father called me from his bedroom and told me, "Son, I am not well. Will you take me to a hospital?" The moon was shining bright. Arxie Dad wasn't able to see. I took him in my arms and on the way to my car, he raised both his RMS to the sky, like he did the day I foray them at Connachan, said, "Oh God, my Lord, bless this boy of mine, for he has been a blessing to us in our old age." I got him to the Presbyter Ian Hospital, and he was there 3 or 4 nights. One morning, Dr. Johannesson, who was a friend of ours, called and asked me to go to the hospital. I reached the hospital. Dr. Johannesson was waiting for me by the receptionist. He approached me and put his right arm around my shoulders and said, "Ben, I am very sorry, but your father died early this morning while asleep. My brother Para happened to be in Chicago, visiting his in-laws, and he and I had gore the day before Arxie visited our father." I immediately called him Airy, told him not to go back to Cincinnati because Dad had passed away. I arranged for his funeral Arxie burial plot. He was buried next to my mother at the Elmwood Cemetery. I ordered a granite head stone which was placed both their graves. He died in February 1945. Chicago, the middle years. It must have been about 3 years after I established my contracting business, 1935, when I met Avery Brune and G.E., who then was president of the American Olympics Committee. He later was elected president and chairman of Olympics Interpti Unal, which position he held for 35 years. Mr. Brundage purchased the famous LaSalle Hotel in Chicago. The LaSalle Hotel was built in 1912-13 by the Stevens brothers, who in 1920 started to build the largest hotel in the world, the well-known Stevens Hotel, with over 4,000 hotel rooms plus several ballrooms and banquet rooms. Not too long after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the government took over the Stevens Hotel for use by Army personnel and for other facilities. Sometime in the 1950s, it was purchased by the Hilton chain and was re-RXRN'd for the president of their corporation. Since its purchase, it has been known as the Conrad Hilton Hotel. The Stevens brothers built their first most elegant hotel, the LaSalle, with its 22-story height and 1,000 rooms, plus a large ballroom, 3 smaller ballrooms, and all other facilities. It was considered to be one of the most outstanding hotels in design and architecture. In 1939, it was purchased by Mr. Brundage. In 1945, about midnight, a fire started in the Silver Lounge on the main floor. In a matter of minutes, the fire swept across the entire paneled lobby, and by the time several battalions of firemen arrived, Ard put the blaze out. The fire had gutted out the first 4 stories completely. The remaining 18 floors were charred and smoke and maggot. The count in loss of life, 62 people died. For 3 years prior to the fire, I had a maintenance contract which required that I keep a crew of 8 to 15 men on a full-time basis to maintain the hotel's needs. Shortly after the tragic fire, Rehabilitat 1 plans were in process. Since I had had previous business dealings with Mr. Brundage for the past II years prior to the fire, both with the Avery Brundage Construction Company and his Roanoke Realty Company, his office called to inform me that Mr. Brundage wished to see me. I went down to see him. Ard, after an hour in his office, he assigned me the task of checking the entire 22-story structure for a complete report plus or minus midge to the painting, signs and murals throughout the interior surfaces. After 3 weeks of investigating compiling the report, I took it to him in person. Based my report, a specification, accompanied with a request for a firm bid, was mailed to other contractors. 4 weeks later, his brother, Chester Brundage, called to me that they had decided to award the contract for painting to Benjamin Decorative Painters Company as per our proposal, but we were to do all mural, art Arxie sign work, including gold leaf numbers on all entry doors, in a separate contract, on a cost and plus basis. In my entire business career of 15 years prior to the fire, this was the largest CN Gall contract I had ever been awarded. For the next 16 months, aside from all other buildings which we maintained for years, I was involved in the restoratichna and rehabilitatum of this magnificent hotel, with my 2 capable men in charge and a crew of between 18 to 30 men, as the job requi read. Having been a charter member of the Contractors Association since its inception in 1930, ARCSI a member of the Board of Directors for 7 years, I was elected to the positum of the Secretary of the Board for the year 1947, and re-elected for a Sakari for the year 1948. In 1949, the Board of Directors with a unanimous vote, elected me as President of the Contractors Association, with a membership of 980. I was re-elected for a second term in 1950. In 1951, at the annual convention of the Painting and Decorating Contractors of America, held in Houston, Texas, I was elected for a term of 3 years, 1951-53, as the chairman of the Ways, Means and Budget Committee of the NATIMAL Association. During the years I served as an elected officer of the Chicago the National Associatims, it was a serious financial loss to my business during the periods I was away from it, but the knowledge ard wide experience I received in my travels over the country and connecting with organizatum work, meeting and knowing many wonderful people throughout this great land, was worth much more than the monetary loss sustained by my contracting business. By 1952, I was very much involved with real estate. There was a prospect that I could manage some property in which we were doing the maintenance upkeep. In 1953, one proceeded to take a course in real estate at the Chicago Real Estate Institute. In the same year, I passed the Illinois Real Estate Brokers Exam and received my broker's license. In time, I remodeled some offices in our own which contained offices, stores, and residential units. Thereafter, I was active in the sales and marketing of properties until my retirement in 1975. Now that I have reached the stage in my life, I cannot hide the fact that all of my adult life I have been unable to escape the haunting memory of my childhood days, with all of the persecutions and massacres endured by the unfortunate Assyrians, especially my own family, and all the nightmares which followed in our dreams at night. It has been said that hardship, adversity, and suffering give an individual strength and stamina with a hope for a better future. If I possess any of the latter qualities, I can only attribute them to my parents, Arks, their Assyrian ancestry. These people have endured and withstood the of the Medes, Persians, Seljuks, and Ottoman Turks since 612 BC, in later years by all of the Islamic peoples of the Middle East. Our most triumphant day came for my parents, older sister Martha, Ardi, on January 9, 1922, when our ocean liner, the SS Roma, docked at the pier in Providence, Rhode Island, and January 18, 1922, the gates of freedom were finally opened. It was not too inge after this that my father admonished me by giving me his unforgettable advice, saying, "Son, let us forget the country of our birth and all our land, viards and property. It is too late for me, but you are just a young boy. You go to school and learn to be like the boys here." I have never forgotten that admonition. In all candor, I must say that, while my childhood was a continuous series of sad ard tragic events, my adulthood was compulsated with joy and happiness when, 48 years ago, on our wedding, the two ministers pronounced Lois and I as man ary wife. Our marriage has produced 3 wonderful children and 3 lovely grandchildren. Percent Isle, I still have some memory of the past. Lois patience, understanding ary devotim have been tremen plus or minusis medicatim in the healing of the scars. Epilogue. Some reflective thoughts. As I grew to adulthood, I became world-conscious, and have always had a keen interest in world affairs and politics. In reviewing the world's history, it indicates that man has had very short periods of peace in relation to his existence this earth. In recent times there was World War I, which was fought and won to make the world safe for democracy. Then World War Ill, which was fought ary William to make the world safe from dictatorships. Within the past 25 years, many sporadic wars have occurred, without any solution for a permanent peace. In violation of all international law, our embassy was taken over and its personnel taken hostages by the Iranians, and with blessed approval of their irrational religious leader. V% Isle, the Russian hammer and sickle and the evil of communism is lurking at us. To fear government is busy agitating the underdeveloped countries against us. And, last but not least, our brittle allies are faltering away from us. This should certainly cause our leaders to give very serious consideration, ary to rise to the reality of the world we are facing. Strong as our country is, it is my fervent hope as a concerned citizen that our President ARCSI, our leaders in Congress, will face up to this challenge by our adversaries. They can best this by keeping our country at its fullest strength, both militarily and politically. I trust that our president and elected officials in Washington will rise above their plus or minus mestic political rhetoric and place the security and welfare of our nation as their main priority, and above their own personal and political interest. May God guide and give our leadership whiz and RN to maintain our ration at peace, through strength. Ben S. Benjamin. November I, 1980.